good day.
Today is Tuesday, 10th February 2026, and let me remind you again, once you've watched this video, if you like what you've heard, then please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, today we have had another interview from the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. He seems to be doing interviews and giving press conferences almost every day now. And again, he's making his views, which I suspect are increasingly becoming the consensus Russian views about the global situation, about the situation between Russia and the United States, and about the conflict in Ukraine, ever clearer, and is taking what I would describe as an extremely tough line about each. Briefly, when it comes to relations with the United States, he is actually, again, I would say, basically scathing. He says that relations with the United States are going in the wrong direction. The United States is unable to move forward with its own proposals, the proposals that it made in Anchorage. We've never been told exactly what those proposals were, and that he does not expect any fundamental improvement in relations between Russia and the United States at any proximate point in time. Lavrov also interestingly says that at the meeting in Anchorage, Putin made very clear to the Americans, to Trump, Witkoff and Rubio, that for the Russians, the condition, the situation of Russian speakers in Ukraine, all parts of Ukraine, not just the four regions, was a matter of very great priority, and that it needed to be sorted out in a final settlement of the conflict. According to Lavrov, Trump then came back and said, well, let's first get the fighting to stop, and then we can discuss all of these issues relating to Russian speakers. And the way that Lavrov discusses it, he says that the Russians essentially rejected that idea outright. They said that this is not how it's going to work out, that you can't bargain away or delay the enforcement of rights, especially of people that you have no direct responsibility for. Obviously talking here about the Americans. And the Russians again insisted that this must form a final part of the full package of the settlement agreement, before which, and Lavrov does not actually say this, but it was very clear from the statements that Putin himself made following the summit in Anchorage, before which the fighting in Ukraine cannot cease. Putin has repeatedly said, the Russians have repeatedly said, that in order for there to be a cessation of hostilities, a final cessation of hostilities in the conflict in Ukraine, the settlement, a full settlement between the Russians and the Ukrainians must have been agreed, and it must have been presumably signed, and at the very least awaiting ratification if it has not been ratified already. So this was what Lavrov said about this. He said that this issue, this centrally important issue for the Russians, must be addressed as well. It is not for Russia just a territorial conflict, a conflict about territory, nor is it a conflict about just the rights of Russians across Ukraine. It is also a conflict about Russian security. And again, Lavrov made out all of that very clear. And he made it clear, as far as I could see, that ultimate underlying Russian objectives, which are not just objectives, but also conditions, that they have not really changed at all. Now, he did say some other very interesting and very strange things. He said that the Russians have had contacts with certain European leaders, and that some of these European leaders have been in contact privately, or if you prefer, secretly, with Moscow through the period of the special military operation. And there was a section of this interview in which he seemed to identify who these leaders were. And they were Emmanuel Macron and Olaf Scholz, the former Chancellor of Germany. And the section in which he discussed these contacts, these Russian contacts with these two individuals, these two European leaders, seemed to me to sort of suggest that these two leaders, Macron and Scholz, had actually undertaken secret, unannounced meetings to Moscow, in which they, over the course of which, they had had direct personal dealings with Russia's president, President Putin. Now, if that is correct, then that is actually very remarkable. It is indeed extraordinary information. I'm just a little wary of accepting my interpretation of his words, because it is in fact so extraordinary that Macron and Scholz might have conducted secret trips to Moscow, that I do wonder whether just possibly there's either been a translation error, or whether I'm reading what Lavrov said correctly. These are the words, and they appear in Russia's foreign ministry website. It's their translation. This is what Lavrov had to say about this. "You know, certain leaders visited Moscow some time ago, including President of France Emmanuel Macron, and there were then contacts with the then German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. All that they were saying in the course of their confidential contacts with President Putin tallied with their public vociferous statements to the effect that Russia had attacked Ukraine, that Russia should stop the war, and that they must defend Ukraine to the last until they inflicted a defeat. By delivering these messages during their contacts, they were attempting to assume a mediating function." Now, perhaps looking at this, Lavrov is not saying that Scholz himself came on a secret trip to Moscow, but Lavrov is saying that there had been private, secret contacts between Scholz and the Russians. But as to Macron, he clearly seems to imply that Macron visited Moscow at some point over the last 4 years and had private meetings with Putin. I have to say, if that is correct, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. But as I said, I'm going to hold back on that. All I will say is that to the extent that Macron and Scholz did reach out to Moscow over the course of the special military operation, they were merely repeating the same things that they have always been saying. The whole crisis is Russia's fault. The NATO powers are in no way to blame. The Russians must capitulate, retreat completely from Ukraine, or agree a ceasefire from Ukraine. And then maybe, just possibly, things might start to come together again, but only on Western terms. And as Lavrov puts it, this is all completely pointless. It didn't take the situation further in any way. And those contacts, perhaps that secret visit to Moscow by Macron, came to nothing. Now, Macron, as it happens, has been speaking again. He made further statements today that Europe does need to resume its dialogue with the Russians, that whether one likes Russia or not, Russia is a neighbour to Europe, and that it is simply not really an option, a policy, not to speak to it. This is very much Macron in the last year of his failed presidency, trying to gain some relevance and continuing to manoeuvre to put himself forward as Europe's chief negotiator in dealings with the Russians. From Lavrov's words, it doesn't look as if the Russians are taking him very seriously. Just say. Anyway, as to the rest, Lavrov also said that it is a misconception that the Americans are really talking about dividing the world into spheres of influence, Russia, China, and the United States, that the Americans are saying that the Western Hemisphere is absolutely theirs and nobody else is allowed there. But as for the rest of the world, it continues to be America first. And that the Americans continue to insist on a predominant position in global affairs in every part of the world, even as they rule that the Western Hemisphere, North and South and Central America, are off limits for any third power. And Lavrov also said that the Americans are now increasingly talking purely in terms of national interests, which is, of course, something that the Russians do understand. And in a very interesting and revealing passage, he said that the Americans have made it fairly clear in their various strategic documents what their objective is. They want to stabilize the situation in Europe in some form. They want some kind of relationship, some kind of more stable relationship with the Russians, for no other reason ultimately than so that they can transfer their forces in Europe to the Asia-Pacific region in order to confront China there. The Russians are well aware of all of this thinking and all of this discussion that is taking place in the United States. And Lavrov said, in response to all of this, that obviously the Russians do intend to pursue their own interests. They understand that even though they don't agree at all with American perspectives, they do not agree with American attempts to gain control of world energy markets, something which Lavrov discussed extensively in his previous interview with BRICS TV. Nonetheless, to the extent that there is some possible commonality of interest between the Americans and the Russians, nonetheless, the Russians are prepared to talk to the Americans in their own interests to see if the Americans in this sort of mood are prepared to concede something. But he went on to say, he repeated again what he said in his interview to BRICS TV, that the Americans, having made their proposal in Anchorage, the proposal which the Russians accepted, which seems to be narrowly about the territorial issue, and which, as I've said already, I think is mostly about sequencing, that the Americans never followed through, that they acted instead to ramp up sanctions against Russia, that they've campaigned against Russian oil exports, and that in reality, despite all of the commitments in Anchorage, which the Americans have never acted on or honoured, relations between Russia and the United States are actually moving in the wrong direction. And he actually said that. He actually used those very words. He actually specifically said that the relationship is going backwards, that instead of things getting better, they are moving backwards. Things continue to go between the Americans and the Russians, continue for the moment to get worse. So there it is. There is no real sense, at least from Lavrov, that the situation is really going to get better. He says that the negotiations between the Americans and the Russians on the conflict issue have a very long way to go. And he also said that he also confirmed that Kushner and Witkoff had not been expected to attend the second meeting, which took place in Abu Dhabi. He did say that some useful items are being discussed between the military officials of Russia and Ukraine, but these don't address the substance of the conflict, the various issues that the Russians are concerned about: Ukraine's demilitarization, its neutral status, the question of its territories, any of those things. These are purely technical matters which might become important if, or as he put it, he hopes when a final settlement is finally agreed, but not before. So it seemed to me that he was downgrading the importance of the dialogue with the Ukrainians and with the Americans. And my overall impression was that he generally doesn't feel that the diplomacy with the United States is going forward in any respect at all. He also incidentally complained about the American refusal to agree to any extension of the START Treaty. And he said that there's now been a decision by President Putin communicated to all of the relevant departments and ministries of the Russian government that the START Treaty is in effect dead, and that it is now up to the Russians themselves to decide how to respond to whatever moves on strategic matters the Americans take. So I think this is correct. Many people still want to believe that there has been some improvement in relations between the United States and Russia since Donald Trump was inaugurated President of the United States back in January of last year. And there has been an improvement in some respects, in that the Americans and the Russians are now at least talking to each other and doing so on a regular and even routine basis. But on the substance, on issues of sanctions, military pressure, political pressure, all of those things, there's been no substantive movement at all. To the extent that there has been movement, it has been in the wrong direction, walking away from arms control treaties, ramping up sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft, and the United States attempting to restrict, to the extent that it can, Russian energy exports. In fact, as Lavrov puts it, the Americans, the President of the United States himself, shortly after Anchorage, started to put pressure, not just on India, but on various other countries as well, to try to get them to stop importing energy from Russia. This just a few weeks after he appeared to have had a good meeting with Putin in Anchorage, a meeting at which Putin came away believing that he'd reached some understanding with Trump, as he agreed to whatever the proposal from Trump was on the territorial issue. So, in some ways, in important respects, the relationship between Russia and the United States is not getting better, according to Lavrov, and it's difficult to argue with him on this. It is actually getting worse. And Lavrov also said that it's a fundamental mistake to think that the Americans really are serious about pulling out of Europe entirely, or that they're ever going to, as Lavrov put it, cut Zelensky and the Europeans down to size. And, well, there should be no expectations on that score. And the Russians should have no illusions about Donald Trump or about the administration that he leads. So overall, I would say this is a bleak view. Now, the big question is this Lavrov's view? Is it the view of a body of opinion within the Security Council, Russia's Security Council, which, by the way, had a further meeting yesterday, supposedly to discuss floods and natural disasters? Certainly an important topic. But if you think that Russia's Security Council convenes only to discuss those matters, well, then I have a bridge to sell you. Anyway, is Lavrov expressing the opinion of just a faction within the Security Council that is critical of Putin and of Putin's outreach to the United States? Or is there something else going on? Is it possible that even as Putin still goes through the motions of negotiating with the Americans and the Ukrainians in Abu Dhabi and elsewhere, even as Putin continues to have endlessly long meetings with Witkoff and Kushner, at which the Americans appear to have refused to answer his questions or shown him documents relating to the security guarantees that the United States is supposed to be negotiating with Ukraine? Is it the case that even as Putin does all of those things and sends negotiators to meet with the Ukrainians and the Americans in places like Abu Dhabi, in reality, he agrees with Lavrov, and he agrees with all of these other officials in the Security Council that Lavrov is in fact authorized by Putin himself to make these comments in these interviews and in these press conferences, perhaps not so much in order to put pressure on the Americans. I doubt that Trump or Rubio or Witkoff pay very much attention to what Lavrov says, which, by the way, is a big mistake, but rather because Putin, through Lavrov, is communicating to the Russian people, and perhaps more specifically to the Russian elite, the Kremlin's deep disappointment and frustration with the whole process of dialogue with the Americans since Donald Trump took office. Could it be that that is what is really happening? Putin doesn't want to rock the boat. He doesn't want the situation with the Americans to get even more dangerous and even more worse, even worse than it already is. It was pointed out to me just a few hours ago by someone, I'm not going to say who, someone very knowledgeable about these matters, that the current administration in Washington is volatile and unstable. In fact, the person who spoke to me said that it could even be described as crazy and extremely dangerous, capable of acting in all sorts of unpredictable and extremely dangerous ways. And that the Russians understand this and understand that they must move very carefully and very slowly, even as they pursue their objectives, given the risks that a strong line, an overly obviously strong line, which the administration might regard as a direct challenge and a potential humiliation if it is not responded to, could result in a completely uncontrolled escalation. Could that be why Putin himself is allowing Lavrov to communicate these messages to the elite and to the Russian people? As I said, we had one interview after another, one press conference after another. We've had statements from the Russian Foreign Ministry as well. But from Putin himself, we continue to have a resounding silence. As it happens, I understand that today is the celebration, the holiday, if you like, of Russia's diplomats. And in previous years, around this time, President Putin comes forward and makes some big speech or comment addressed to the diplomats, congratulating them on their hard work and laying out certain realities about Russian foreign policy. So far, as of the time of making of this program, he hasn't done that. He's had important meetings with important officials. He had a very interesting meeting, for example, with the mayor of Moscow, Mayor Sobyanin, which looked at the economic situation in Moscow and the development of the high-tech industries there, including the building of an entirely new factory for Russia's Mikoyan Bureau, the people who produce the MiG fighter jets. I'm not sure what that's all about, just saying. But anyway, he's had all of these meetings, Putin has had, but he has not addressed foreign policy questions since he met with Witkoff and Kushner in the Kremlin on the 23rd of January. When I say he has not addressed foreign policy questions, he's not addressed questions about relations with the United States or the conflict in Ukraine in any formal venue so far. He appears to be intentionally giving Lavrov the spotlight, giving Lavrov every opportunity to sound off and to say what he thinks. Yesterday, I spoke about how it did seem to me that there are actual tensions within the Kremlin. Thinking about this more, and in light of that comment that was made to me a few hours ago, I now wonder whether perhaps it's something more straightforward going on, that Putin is playing a careful game, even as he's using Lavrov to message the Russian elite specifically, that expectations of a diplomatic and political breakthrough with the Americans on Ukraine or on any other issue is still far in the distance, and that in reality, the relationship isn't improving. In important respects, it is getting worse. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about Lavrov. Meanwhile, of course, the war itself goes on. And in fact, there's been a lot of developments in the war since I last discussed the situation on the front lines and in the sky, which is about 48 to 72 hours ago. Firstly, it's important to say that Russian attacks across Ukraine on its energy system continue. In fact, they happen every single day. The attacks have been mostly carried out by drones rather than missiles. We've not had the rain of missiles that we had a few days ago. Though probably more missile strikes will take place fairly soon. But nonetheless, the Russians continue to send large numbers of Geryon drones, which now come in many different families across Ukraine. And these attack targets right across Ukraine, and they do so every night. Ukraine's energy companies continue to report a deteriorating situation. I understand that the nuclear power plants have still not resumed supply of electricity to Ukraine's energy system. And temperatures in Ukraine have started to fall again, and a real possibility of further strikes by the Russians most certainly does exist. Moreover, I read a report which appears to have a Ukrainian origin that it is indeed the case that outside Kiev, air defense in Ukraine, across Ukraine, has essentially ceased to exist. The Ukrainians have largely run out of air defense missiles. Apparently, several Patriot missile batteries that still serve in the Ukrainian armed forces now have actually no interceptor missiles that they can launch. The launchers and the radars are still there, but they have no means to shoot anything down because they no longer have any missiles. Reloads for the missiles are in short supply. And given the scale of the Russian attacks, which take place every night, it is impossible for the United States or the Europeans to keep up with the scale of demand for interceptor missiles that is coming from Ukraine. So the Ukrainians are obliged to husband what air defense assets they still have. Apparently, they're trying to concentrate them to the extent they can around Kiev itself, and I suspect close to some places along the front lines. And, well, even here, even in Kiev, we can see that the missiles regularly get through. And I will repeat my own view, which is that the Patriots, which are the most advanced missiles that Ukraine has, can shoot down aircraft, and they can shoot down subsonic missiles, and perhaps sometimes supersonic cruise missiles. But against hypersonic missiles like the Kinjal and the Tsarkon, they are mostly ineffective. Against ballistic missiles like the Iskander, they are also mostly ineffective. They struggle to deal with the KH-22-32 anti-ship missiles, which also have very high supersonic speeds when they come down in an almost vertical dive. And of course, against the Oreshnik, they are useless entirely. They are not able to intercept the Oreshnik, at least the Oreshnik warheads, when these reach their targets in Ukraine. And I don't know of any single responsible analyst who thinks otherwise. So, Ukraine, to all intents and purposes, no longer has a fully functional air defense system. And what air defense system it possesses is largely useless against the sort of missiles that the Russians are now using in increasing quantities in the war. I'm going to make a further guess that as developments, military developments continue, we're going to see more and more Tsarkon hypersonic missiles being used. These are hypersonic cruise missiles. I believe that they present a particular challenge for the Ukrainians to shoot down, even if there is a theoretical possibility of shooting them down as they come close to impacting on their targets. And we've already seen many more Kinjals and Iskanders being used, and I believe that gradually we will see the number of these missiles, these very advanced missiles that are being used by the Russians, they will grow. And the subsonic cruise missiles, the KH-101s launched by Russia Strategic Aviation, and the Kalibr missiles launched by the Russian Black Sea Fleet, they will continue to appear. But they will be used against secondary targets in Ukraine's rear, where the air defences are either patchy or where they no longer exist. Now, not only are Ukraine's air defence missiles proving ineffectual, but so are its manned fighter jets. Ukraine still has a small number of Sukhoi 27 fighter jets left over from the period of the Soviet Union. As we know, it has been supplied with a significant number of F-16s. And again, it's worth remembering the enormous hype around the F-16 deliveries, the various claims that there were that the F-16s would be a game changer in the war, that they would provide Ukraine with local air superiority in areas of the front lines, and that they might even be used for launching missiles inside Russia itself. The F-16s, to say it straightforwardly, have proved a bust. They're not able to shoot down the incoming Russian missiles and drones in anything like this, on anything like the scale that would be needed to turn the tide in the war in the sky. And the Ukrainians themselves have now increasingly been saying that the F-16s, and by the way, the Mirage 2000s supplied to Ukraine by Macron, that they are helpless against the far more advanced Russian fighter jets, the Sukhoi 57 fifth generation fighters, the Sukhoi 35s, and the MiG 31s. The Russian aircraft are not only far more advanced and probably better piloted, but critically, the Russians have far more powerful radars and, more importantly, far more powerful missiles with much longer ranges of a sort that Ukraine and its air force cannot match. There's actually a good discussion of this whole topic on the YouTube channel Millennium 7, in which the commentator there, I forget his name, actually pointed out that one of the big lessons of the war in Ukraine is that air-to-air combat now takes place at a distance using long-range missiles and powerful radars. The era of dogfighting, of Top Gun and all of that, for the moment at least, is ended. And I will add to that something which is little known, but perhaps also highly relevant, that it seems that the advanced Russian fighter jets, with their very powerful radars, are able to direct surface-to-air missiles like the S-400 and certain of the more advanced versions of the S-300 family onto aerial targets that they spot with their radars. So, for example, a MiG-31 observing a Ukrainian fighter jet is able to inform a Russian missile battery of the existence of this fighter jet. The battery then launches a missile, and it is the MiG-31 that then guides the missile towards its target. So anyway, the war in the sky continues to get worse for Ukraine, and the situation in the cities continues to get far worse for Ukraine. But the situation on the ground is now deteriorating, and it is deteriorating rapidly as well. Now, about a week ago, I read a very interesting article in Radovka, Russian nationalist, patriotic newspaper published in Smolensk, but one which is extremely well informed about the situation on the front lines. It said that the Russian forces, the Russian soldiers in Zaporozhye region, have been increasingly puzzled by the weak resistance that the Ukrainians have been putting up. The Russians consider Zaporozhye region and the city of Zaporozhye to be a critical theatre in the war. But instead of the Ukrainians sending to Zaporozhye region some of their best military units and fighters to try to defend Zaporozhye region, the dribbles of reinforcements that the Ukrainians were sending were made up very much of second category soldiers, soldiers with low morale, low training, perhaps in poor physical condition, the kind of soldiers that really would not be up to withstanding the Russians as they advance. And Radovka said that there was increasing speculation amongst the Russian military that the Ukrainians were actually husbanding reserves in Zaporozhye region and were planning to conduct some kind of counterattack. And this was why the Ukrainians were not sending Russian their best troops or their good troops to fight the Russians in Zaporozhye region. And, well, it struck me that if Radovka was saying that, it was almost certainly true, and that Radovka, which is, as I said, very well informed about the situation on the battle lines, had probably been tipped off by its contacts within the Russian military that some kind of Ukrainian counterattack in Zaporozhye region was coming. And sure enough, over the last couple of days, the counterattack came. And there was a great deal of excitement in the first couple of hours as the counterattack unveiled. And there were various claims, especially in the Ukrainian media, that the Starlink cutoff was playing a decisive role in making that possible. That the reality was that because the Russians use Starlink for their communications, there was really no possibility, no prospect anymore of the Russians coordinating and organizing an effective defense against this Ukrainian counterattack. And there were all sorts of predictions and claims and expectations that the Ukrainians were going to recapture Ternovata, the important village in Zaporozhye region that the Russians have recently captured, and push the Russians back to the east bank of the Gaichul River, with the Ukrainians perhaps even succeeding in re-entering the city of Guliapolye, which the Russians have also recently captured itself. Well, those were the claims. They have turned out to be catastrophically, disastrously wrong. Now, again, it's highly likely that the Ukrainians are going to persist in this counterattack for several days or weeks. But an emerging consensus is starting to appear that the counterattack around Ternovata was a disaster, that the Russians, as that Radovka article suggested, were aware that it was coming, that they were prepared for it. And anyway, the Russians were ready, and the Ukrainian armored vehicles and the soldiers rumbled towards the Russian positions, only to be picked off by the Russians using their drones and their artillery and their aviation. They were picked off one by one, and the Ukrainians suffered very, very heavy losses in consequence. And, well, I have to say that one of the other things that I suspect probably explains why this counterattack, at least so far, has been completely unsuccessful is because of the Ukrainian officer who supposedly was its commander. And he has been identified as a man called Valentin Manko. Now, Manko is an extraordinary figure who has been much talked about in Ukraine and on the Russian part of the internet. Firstly, the first thing to say about him is that though he did serve, apparently, for a time in the Ukrainian army during the 2014 fighting, he has no training as a military officer and certainly not as a commander of troops. He does have a very colourful history of activities in far-right groups like Right Sector, an organisation that played a critical role in the Maidan protests of 2013 and 2014, and which, by the way, has, with some people, a very ruthless and sinister reputation. And there are also reports that Manko himself has been involved in all kinds of criminal or semi-criminal activities. In fact, there was even a time when he apparently had to flee Ukraine, and the Ukrainian authorities issued a notice against him via Interpol. That, of course, was cancelled, and Manko returned safely to Ukraine. And he's continued to play an active role in Ukrainian politics. And at some point, he seems to become acquainted with General Sirsky, who is now the overall military commander in Ukraine. And Sirsky appointed Manko to command the so-called assault brigades. These are supposedly elite formations that Sirsky has established after he became overall military commander in place of General Zaluzhny. There's been talk that these assault brigades form a kind of Praetorian guard for Sirsky himself. I'm not going to explore that. But anyway, Manko is supposed to be their commander, and apparently he has earned a reputation for being an extremely ruthless officer, ruthless in terms of the lives of his own men, who he often throws into attacks and counterattacks which are not properly prepared and which result in very heavy losses. However, he is close to Sirsky himself, and he is said to be very loyal to Sirsky, and for that reason, despite his inadequacies as a commander, Sirsky continues to protect him and continues to promote him. Or at least, according to the reports today, has been doing so. Because today the reports say that Manko was in overall charge of this counterattack in Zaporozhye, the counterattack which has gone so disastrously wrong, given, as I said, that Manko has no background in military command. It does seem very, very strange to put him in charge of an operation like this, if that is what really happened. But anyway, the reports say that today, Sirski, his friend and protector, in light of the debacle that has happened, has been left with no choice but to sack him. And the announcement of Manko's sacking has now been published, apparently, in Ukraine. On the topic of Manko, this does not, of course, mean that he's going to cease to be a person of importance in Ukraine. He's probably going to reconstitute himself, reinvent himself as a blogger, very much on Ukraine's ultra-nationalist far right, a person who will complain about the betrayal of Ukraine by people like Sirski and other members of the Ukrainian political class. And of course, inevitably, he's going to gain a certain amount of traction, even as he does so. But anyway, it looks as if this counterattack, for the moment at least, has been an utter disaster. It has completely and entirely failed. It doesn't follow that because it failed at the outset, the Ukrainians will give up on it. It may be that they will place a more effective and better trained commander in Manko's place. It's likely that they will resume their attacks later. It's possible that they might even regain some ground, in which case I fully expect all sorts of people writing about these successful Ukrainian counterattacks and the failure of the Russians to repel them and how the Russians are supposedly facing an operational crisis in the area of Ternovata. What invariably happens is that these counterattacks eventually lose momentum, they ebb away, and the Russians then go back on the attack and they recapture whatever ground they might have ceded it, even as these attacks, counterattacks happen. That has been the iron rule up to now, ever since the 2023 fighting, and I don't have any doubt that it will continue so. Anyway, even as this fiasco, this debacle played out, in near Ternovata, there are reports that the Russians have captured Zalizhnichne, an important settlement, small town, west of Orekhov, east of Gulyapolye. That would imply that the Russians have indeed broken through the main defence lines and that Orekhov itself is now well within their sights as they advance towards it from the east. Now, that's not the only place where there's been further news. There continues to be more Russian advances in northern Donbass towards Slavyansk. And there's been some changes in some of the mapping projects showing the situation in Liman as having changed radically, and with the Russians now occupying a significant part of Liman, having basically cut off the Ukrainian defenders in Liman from resupply. I've said this before, I will repeat it again. I believe that both Konstantinovka and Liman are going to pass fully under Russian control within this month. And further north still, in the Kupiansk area, I noticed that again some of the mapping projects have almost eliminated, deleted the grey zone areas close to Liman on the east bank, close to Kupiansk, on the east bank of the Oskol River, which leads me to think that, again, as the commander of Group of Forces West claimed some weeks ago, the cauldron the area where the Ukrainian troops had been trapped east of the Oskol River has now been effectively eliminated, releasing more Russian troops to advance through Kupiansk further to the west or potentially northwards as well. There are also lots of activities by the Russians in Sumy, Chernigov and Kharkov regions, but I'm not going to discuss those in this program. So the situation continues to deteriorate, and there continue to be all sorts of claims about these enormous Russian losses. There is, in fact, a long article today in the Financial Times, very, very thinly supported by any reporting, by the way. It's mostly assertive about how the Russian losses over the last few months supposedly have surged. But I noticed that one of the senior commanders of the Azov forces in Ukraine has now himself come out and cast doubt on these claims of Russian losses. He has made it fairly clear that he doesn't believe in them, in these claims, and he said that it is foolish for Ukrainians to believe that the Russians are going to be obliged to end the war on unsatisfactory terms because they have run out of men. Now, on that last point, just to repeat, across Ukraine, the Ukrainian mobilization service continues to seize men in the streets, out in public, sometimes using considerable violence. I was informed by a Hungarian acquaintance of mine that she is aware that a chemical company, a Chinese-owned chemical company in eastern Hungary, which used to send trucks full of chemical products into Ukraine, not so much for customers in Ukraine itself, but on onward passage to customers in other places, has had to stop doing so because Ukrainian recruiters have been seizing Hungarian drivers, driving these lorries and taking them off the lorries and have pressed them into the Ukrainian army and sent them to the battlefronts. These are not Ukrainian citizens. These are Hungarian and European Union citizens. Though it's fair to say, if this story is true, and by the way, I have no doubt it is true, that the European authorities are saying absolutely nothing about it. So anyway, this to me, these facts to me, tell one who is really suffering the impossibly high level of casualties. There are no reports of anything like that taking place in Russia. The Russians continue to recruit on a voluntary basis. They appear to have no issues with recruitment. They continue to build up their forces in that way. Now, at the same time, I noticed that the Institute for the Study of War has now also confirmed that which I was predicting some weeks ago, that the Russians are likely to launch a major offensive against Ukraine in the spring, and that the focus of this offensive will be capturing the remainder of Donbass and of Zaporozhye region, including the city of Zaporozhye. And, well, I don't place a vast amount of credence on what the Institute for the Study of War says, but I have no doubt at all that such a major offensive is indeed coming. Last year, Russia began its big spring-summer offensive in April, and I would guess that that is roughly the time when we should expect this big offensive to start. And I read somewhere that the Ukrainians themselves are now ringing alarm bells. They say that General Teplinsky's group of forces, Dnieper, the force that is gradually advancing towards the city of Zaporozhye from the south, and which in some places is just 12 kilometers up south of the city of Zaporozhye, and whose reconnaissance groups, using the dried out and icy Kakhovka Reservoir as a route to go deep into the city of Zaporozhye itself, have been conducting scouting at the very in the very center of the city. Anyway, there are reports that this particular group of forces is being built up by the Russians in preparation, perhaps, for the attack on the city of Zaporozhye that we're likely to see develop in the summer. If I had to make a guess on the way things will play out, I think in the Zaporozhye region, once the Russians have finished with this Ukrainian counterattack that's currently ongoing, the Russians will complete the encirclement and eventually the capture of Orekhov. I expect this to happen perhaps in March, early April. Then, after the thaw, the Rasputitsa, the Russians will begin their major offensive towards the city of Zaporozhye itself. And it is likely that Zaporozhye city itself will be under siege by midsummer. Anyway, that's my guess of the timetable and of the schedule. So that is the military situation. Now, some days ago, Zelensky said that the United States had told Ukraine and Russia that it wanted to see the war end by June, and that this was basically a deadline that had been imposed by the United States, and that the Americans had informed both the Ukrainians and the Russians of this, and have threatened coercive action on each if they refuse or fail to come to terms by that date. Well, I did say at the time that I wondered whether Zelensky was really communicating something that the Americans had told him, or whether, in fact, Zelensky saying this was his way of getting the Americans to put more pressure on the Russians to get the Russians to stop their advance by, at the latest, mid-June, before the Russians, in other words, really get going in terms of the siege of Zaporozhye and the siege of the two big remaining cities in Donbass, Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. Well, I may have been right to wonder that, because the US ambassador to NATO, Matthew Whitaker, who is, by the way, a very much a hardliner, has come out now and said that, as far as he's aware, no such deadline, in fact, exists. The United States has not imposed any deadlines of that kind, either on Ukraine or on Russia. And I suspect, by the way, that that is true. Anyway, there it is. That is the military situation. The diplomacy, as I said, is not going anywhere fast. I think people are overemphasizing the importance of this meeting in Abu Dhabi. And I got the clear impression, especially after the Valdai attack back in December, that the Russians were re-examining and rethinking their approach in terms of their dialogue with the Trump administration. I said that it seemed to me, based on what Russian officials like Ushakov and Putin himself had said, that the Russians were in the process of hardening their stance. And, well, there's a good piece on Sona 21, Larry Johnson's invaluable blog, in which Larry Johnson himself says, in light of Lavrov's statements, that the Russians do indeed seem to be hardening their demands. We don't yet know what, if any, concessions the Russians have retreated from since Valdai. But certainly there does seem to have been, over the last week or so, a notable hardening in Russian rhetoric. And that does suggest to me that the Russians are indeed hardening their stance with Ukraine and don't expect any sort of diplomatic resolution of the conflict in Ukraine very soon. And going back to the analyses that Gordon Hahn has made, he tends to take a more optimistic view of the negotiations than I do, but he says, and I have no doubt that he is right, that the longer the negotiations continue, the more critical the situation for Ukraine becomes. Ukraine is short of men, it's short of air defense missiles, it's short of weapons on the front lines. In my opinion, its achievements with drones have been overrated and are now dwarfed by what the Russians drew in the drone war. And the drone attacks on Russian territory seem to have been mostly unsuccessful. And, well, Gordon Hahn has his doubts that this can go on for very much longer. Roger Boyce, the British Times journalist, thought that Ukraine might have no further than May, no later than May, up to May, before things start to break down. He might be right, but Gordon Hahn certainly believes, whether it's as soon as May or later, that we are steadily approaching that moment when we're going to see a breakdown in Ukrainian defences. Well, there it is. That's, as I said, the state of the war at the present time. There will be more opportunities soon for Putin to come out and to make statements about the political and military situation and the diplomacy. And presumably when he does, that is when we're going to get clarity. But the fact that he is choosing to remain silent, to my mind, tells us a great deal about the state of the war at this time and the state of the diplomacy also at this time. There was some talk a few days ago, about a week ago, of another telephone call between Putin and Trump coming or being prepared. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, has cast doubt on that. He said that there's no plan or intention to hold such a conversation anytime soon. Of course, this could be misdirection. It may be that a call is going to happen over the next few days or hours. But if it does, I certainly will be surprised in light of all of the things that Lavrov himself has been saying. Anyway, there it is. This is the state of the diplomacy. This is the state of the war. Despite optimistic claims that you still get, like the one in the Financial Times, that the Russians are stuck. The reality is far otherwise. Ukraine is facing a crisis at multiple levels, a crisis so severe that it is impossible to see how short of a miracle it can come through. And, well, I don't believe that miracles come, especially not for people like Zelensky. And, of course, it's likely that before long he's going to lose one of his dear friends in Europe, his dear friend Keir Starmer, who is, of course, a soon-to-be victim of the Zelensky curse. Now, I spent a lot of yesterday's programme discussing the political crisis in Britain. I said that I thought there was a reasonable chance that Starmer might fall over the course of yesterday. It was, in fact, touch and go. There's an article in The Guardian which says that at 1:30 in the afternoon, London time, Starmer's team thought it was all but over. There'd been attempts yesterday to get senior ministers in the British government to come out and support Starmer. And throughout the entire morning, none of them did so. And it did look for a time as if Starmer would probably not see out the day. But then someone came to his rescue, and that was the enormously ambitious and enormously incompetent cabinet minister, Wes Streeting, the champion of the Blairites, the friend of Morgan McSweeney, the person who the Blairites really want to see as prime minister. And he came to Starmer's rescue by himself trying to organise a coup. And he did this in the most incompetent way imaginable. He got his friend, the Labour leader in Scotland, to call for Starmer's removal. Bear in mind that Morgan McSweeney, Starmer's now resigned or dismissed chief of staff, is also based in Scotland, though he's actually of Irish origin. So one could see how all of these things come together, how all the contacts in Scotland might take place. Anyway, this person then came out and said that it was time for Starmer to go for the good of the party and the good of the people of Scotland and the good of the people of Britain. And at the same time, Wes Streeting published an article in The Guardian saying how it was completely untrue that he was actually a close friend of Peter Mandelson. All of the stories which we've been hearing for the last decade telling us what a great friend of Peter Mandelson he was were wrong, all wrong. And in order to know, to demonstrate this, he was going to publish some email correspondence which he had exchanged with Peter Mandelson, showing how cool the relationship between these two men actually was. And of course, just by coincidence, just by chance, these emails all showed what Wes Streeting thinks of Keir Starmer, how he has no economic plan, no economic policy, how he's completely hopeless in every respect, and all of that. So everybody could see that all of these manoeuvres were all intended to one end and to one purpose, to get Starmer ousted as Prime Minister and to make Wes Streeting the new leader of the Labour Party in his place. The coup miscarried for two reasons. Firstly, Streeting himself did not resign. He made all of these statements about Starmer in this convoluted and indirect way, but he didn't himself come forward publicly, say that Starmer was damaged goods, needed to go and resign from the cabinet. Had Streeting done that, then it's quite possible that Starmer would have fallen. So that was one reason why the coup miscarried. The second reason, as became very clear over the course of the day, and as continues to be clear today, is that most people within the government and within the parliamentary light party don't actually like Wes Streeting. So there was an artificial rally around Starmer, which enabled him to get through the day. This will start to peter out over the next couple of days. It's still possible, in fact, it's still very possible that by the end of this week, Starmer's position will start to collapse again. But anyway, he managed to survive Monday, which was a critical day. In the meantime, if we go from the ridiculous to the potentially tragic, we still have an enormous gathering of forces, military forces, in the Middle East. And it is said that Prime Minister Netanyahu is on his way to the United States to meet with President Trump. And the word is that Netanyahu is going to come telling Trump to take a hard line in the negotiations with the Iranians, not to cut any deal with them, except a deal on conditions which the Iranians will never accept. And if that advice is heeded by the president and his officials, then it is very likely that we will see a collapse in the negotiations, and then we will be back into a situation that looks like war between the United States and Iran. Now, since I did my program yesterday, more pictures have appeared of MI-28 helicopter gunships supplied to Iran from Russia. There is no doubt at all that these aircraft have indeed been supplied by Russia. And I discussed in my program yesterday how the Russians do seem to be taking a very strong interest in affairs in Iran. The Chinese and the Russians have both published statements making clear that they cannot be indifferent and will not stand aside as the crisis in Iran deepens. So we are not just on the brink of a war between Iran and the United States. We could be on the brink of a superpower confrontation of a kind we have not seen since the 1973 Yom Kippur War between the United States and the Soviet Union over the conflict between the Arab states and Israel that took place in 1973. So this is an extremely dangerous situation. I don't know whether people in Washington understand quite how dangerous it potentially is, but we could indeed be heading towards a crisis. Well, we'll see. In the meantime, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Don't forget also to check us out, to support that you can support us via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Don't forget too to check out our new Substack site. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.